Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lenman. My guest today is author, lawyer, financial expert, prolific writer on financial and related issues, and candidate, Ellen Brown. In her own words, she threw her bonnet into the ring. Well, we'll let Ellen discuss that and explain what's going on. I'd like Ellen to become a combination, the first ever combo Treasury Secretary, Fed Chairman. Chairwoman.
Well, thanks,
Ellen,
dear.
You're gonna run for Treasurer of the state of California. Well, let me say one thing first. Ellen, you are a passionate and responsible supporter of public banking. It's the only solution to the deplorable system we have that's controlled by Wall Street crooks. And your two books on the subject are absolutely required reading, Web of Debt, and what I think of as the sequel to Web of Debt, your book on the public banking solution. Oh, indeed it is. We could talk about your books, talk about your candidacy, and why you're running. Ellen, congrats.
Thank you. Well, I'm running largely because, you know, in California we had a bill, AB 2500, which passed both houses of the legislature a little over 2 years ago for a feasibility study for a state-owned bank, and Jerry Brown did not sign it. So it died on the vine. His argument was that we had a banking committee and or commission, and that we could do that in-house. But of course, we've never heard any more about it. So Laura Wells is running for controller, and I'm running for treasurer. And our vision would be, as those offices are responsive only to the voters, so you actually get a seat at the table, and we could be talking to those people that are making the decisions, and we think we could persuade them of the absolute sanity and common sense of establishing our own bank. California is the ninth largest economy in the world. At one time, it was the sixth largest economy in the world. There is no reason it shouldn't have its own bank. There's no reason that North Dakota is doing so much better than not only California, but every other state. California has the highest poverty rate in the country, which is shocking. I went to university in the 1960s and 1970s under Pat Brown, who was Jerry Brown's father. And I graduated from Berkeley in 1968, and tuition was free at that time. It's now $13,000 a year for an in-state student. My law school at UCLA, also a state school, was $700 a year in the 1970s. It's now $45,000 a year for an in-state student. It's absolutely unbelievable. You would get out of school with this huge, huge debt burden on your shoulders. You're forced to work for the man. You know, you've got to work for the machine in order to pay that sort of debt off. I mean, they absolutely have us trapped in debt. And we think we can get out of it, but it's the banking system that has trapped us into that horrible debt, and we could fix the banking system by having our own bank. Then there's the question, it turns out that now, with all these recent lawsuits against the big banks, particularly JPMorgan Chase has been either admitted or settled up on over a dozen major lawsuits on actual felonious type fraud in conjunction with its dealings. For example, the interest rate manipulations affect, was it $400 trillion worth of contracts? In other words, huge huge manipulations of the system, which have cost us huge amounts of money. Why are we continuing to bank with these people? I mean, they've been caught in all these frauds, and yet we do it because we think we have no alternative. But we do have an alternative, and that's to set up our own bank, and it's not like it's never been done before. North Dakota has done it since 1919, and they're a shining example of what you can achieve. And if you want to say they've got oil, well, California actually has more oil, for one thing. Texas and Alaska have oil, and they're not doing nearly so well. But there are other countries that don't have oil, like Costa Rica is my favorite model at the moment. 80% of banks in Costa Rica, or 80% of deposits are in publicly owned banks. So people love these banks. They won't give them up, even though the IMF has leaned on them, we've leaned on them. Everybody's tried to get them to privatize these banks, but they're so good for the people. They have lower interest, they're a better deal for the people, and they're totally safe. They don't need FDIC insurance because the people own the bank. I mean, it's a government bank. They don't need government backing. They are the government. So,
oh, it's such a slam dunk story, Ellen. I mean, the reason public banks aren't allowed in America, except for North Dakota, maybe there's a small community somewhere that does something, who knows, but except for North Dakota, as far as we know, that's the only public bank in America, the only one I'm aware of. Are you aware of any other community or any other bank that is similar to Bank of North Dakota?
No, there are state iBanks, infrastructure banks, but that's really a different model. That's really sort of a public-private thing where you're taking in, you know, private money, and they're not depository banks. So the Bank of North Dakota is the only bank where the government puts its own money on deposit in this bank, and then they leverage that money into credit. So they basically double their money because the money's still there on deposit in the bank, while they're able to issue the same sum in credit.
I was so impressed by the way in Web of Debt, and by the way, let me give you the exact correct title of your other book. It's called The Public Bank Solution, From Austerity to Prosperity, and indeed it is. Public banking is, I should say, does well, it assures going from austerity to prosperity. And in Web of Debt, you certainly remember, you wrote it, Ellen, and I wrote about it. I wrote about it a number of times because I referred back to it in a number of articles after writing about Web of Debt. The fact that colonial America, I mean, not only do public banks exist in many countries around the world, and a country like Costa Rica having 80% of its banks, but many countries, the BRICS countries, other countries, it's such an obvious solution to the way you should run banks. They run responsibly instead of the way Wall Street crooks run them. But in colonial America for 25 years, this country, when it was, you know, it was before America became America, for 25 years had sustained prosperity. It was income tax free. They had tariffs in those days, and it was inflation free. Now, just imagine, it wasn't a matter of colonial America's size. It was because of its policies. You know, across the Atlantic, you had Britain that was mired in all kinds of problems because it had the Bank of England. Well, America wasn't burdened with the Bank of England. Well, it got reburdened again. That's another story. But we could have the same system again. We could have a responsible system. We never would have been going through the terrible Main Street depression that we've been going through since 2008, and that's exactly what it is, with 23% unemployment, and all the numbers that come out of Washington are rigged. Our GDP isn't anything like the way they report it. Inflation is 2 to 3 times higher than what they report, and unemployment 7%. What a laugh. Real unemployment is over 23%. Ellen, you're running on the Green Party ticket. I mean, you're going up against the machine. It's a very tough thing to do. And, of course, the Green Party nationally last November, I forget how many votes they got. It wasn't more than, I don't even think they got a couple of million. I think it was a very small total. So it's a very tough row to hoe because you get no publicity and you take no corporate money, so you can't go out on the campaign trail and let everybody know exactly what you do and why your platform is so important. That's a shame.
Well, but we take no corporate money, and therefore the few Greens that do get in actually make a difference. Like in Richmond, the city of Richmond in California, she's a Green, Gail McLaughlin, and she has had the nerve to stand up to the banks and take properties by eminent domain and then refinance them for, well, they haven't done it. They're still still working on it. But anyway, she's holding her ground on that because she can do it, because she's not beholden to these corporate interests. So that's the point of not taking corporate money. And agreed, probably not much chance of beating John Chang. But what we can do is get into the finals. Now in California, we have this strange new system called, it's called a Louisiana primary or a jungle primary, where you have all the candidates are running against each other in June in a single primary. So you're running against the Republicans and the Democrats, and everybody else is just, it's a free-for-all to the finish. And then the two candidates that make it after that go on the ballot in November. But in both times, you can put a ballot statement. So for $25 a word, we can put up a ballot statement saying public banking and why it's a good idea and why the state should have it. In other words, we can get this idea before all the voters, not that all the voters are all the citizens anymore, but you can get it before a lot more people than you would be able to just writing articles or the things that I do that go into the places that our people read, but not necessarily the people who don't pay a lot of attention to these issues. So that's a great mouthpiece for public banking. That alone, if we get a ballot statement up there, will have been worth the effort. And where I think ultimately how we would get a public bank in California would be with an initiative. But you can't, with an initiative is voter-driven, so it trumps whatever Congress says. It trumps what the governor says. If we get an initiative passed, they have to do it up in Sacramento. But before we can bring an initiative for a publicly owned bank, people have to understand what we're talking about, and that's why we have to keep getting this idea in front of them. It seems so obvious once you get it. But there are a few critical things that people don't understand. One is that banks actually create money. In other words, our credit comes from banks, and if we own the bank, then we have access to this big credit machine, and we can get it. We as a state or a city or a county, whoever sits at the bank, can get it interest-free. So that saves, and then people think, well, interest, that's a couple percent, but it's not. If you count that year after year, it's 50%. So you double the cost of public projects by financing them into the future. In fact, you can do worse than that. There are these capital appreciation bonds that school districts in California have signed onto because they can't get money any other way, where they're paying 300% interest over the life of the contract. In other words, they're paying three times principal. I think there's something like $9 billion in capital appreciation bonds, and in 30 or 40 years, they will owe $35 billion on it. So virtually four times as much. And Santa Ana committed to capital appreciation bonds where they would be paying 1,000%, 10 times principal in 40 years. And that actually, Jerry Brown thought that was he was aghast at that and changed the rule and made it so they can only go to four times principal. But even so, that's huge. That's a huge amount of money that we could save if we owned the bank and we got the interest back.
Well, that's exactly right. It makes no sense for either a nation or a state or a city or a small community to pay interest to bankers when it can have its own bank and pay no interest. We're in a low interest rate, practically a zero interest rate environment now, but there are other times when rates are much, much higher, and because interest rates today are literally on the floor, They have no place to go in the future but up, and at some point they will be up. And I remember very well, I'm sure you do this too, Ellen, you go back to the 1980s when there were double-digit interest rates year after year after year. I mean, it was wonderful. You could take out, a bank CD and get a rate of interest you can't even imagine now. I still have some canceled bank books in a bureau drawer. I think I got interest on my CD as high as 17 or 18%. It's impossible to imagine anything like that today. Or at Treasury notes. I remember buying a couple of Treasury notes and getting 15% interest. I thought that was a gravy train. You know, I mean, you can't miss on that. The only mistake I made was, you know, selling them when they matured. I should have just held on to the darn things. I bought a long-term one because it was a great bond bull market that went on year after year after year. And you could have made as much money on bonds as you made on stocks, maybe even more. And if you bought the zero coupon bonds, oh, my God, you could have made a fortune. I never did that. But those were those days, and these are these days, and they're completely different. So the bankers can go to the Fed and get practically free money, and yet if you have a credit card and people are foolish enough to pay interest on their credit cards, instead of paying off the balance every month, they let the debt accumulate, and they pay, what, 17, 18, 20% interest? Well, the interest that the credit card companies borrow for practically zero interest, and they charge you up to 20% or more. I mean, anybody is crazy to pay that kind of interest rate. Better to go to the bank and take out a loan if you can get one. Better not to have any debt in the first place, personal debt. I mean, you need it for a mortgage. You need it to buy a car or something like that, but you certainly don't need it to go out and buy clothes or the stuff that most people do, unless you pay off your balance every month, which is what I do. I have never paid a credit card company, Ellen, one penny in my entire life.
Yeah, but there's a catch to that, too. I was just about to write about that. I mean, I did write it, but I haven't posted it yet. That we pay 2% to the merchants.
Yeah.
Or the merchant pays 2%, and they raise the prices by that amount to cover it. So we're paying an extra 2%, and we're not. Excuse me, that's per trade. So on average, we're talking about a two-week loan. If you pay off your credit card at 30 days, then your average loan is 15 days, you know, anywhere from 1 day to 30 days. So a 15-day loan, a two-week loan, you're paying 2% on it because the merchant charges you by raising the prices. Mm. And so over the course of the year, compounded annually, that's 60% we're paying for credit cards. And we're forced to do it. Even if you don't use a credit card, the merchant is forced to raise his prices for everybody. He can't discriminate. Now, there are some states that allow you to give a lower price for cash. It didn't used to be that way until this big lawsuit came down last year. But in California is one state where you still can't do that. So everybody pays the extra 2%, whether or not you're using a credit card. And it's a hidden fee. Everybody thinks, oh, well, I pay off my bill at the end of the month, so I'm getting credit for free. Or I'm getting those frequent flyer miles. What a good deal. And so you purposely use your credit card even when you could have used cash. I mean, I do that, even when I could have used cash because I want those frequent flyer miles.
Oh, I agree with you, absolutely. I mean, we're stuck with that extra 2%, as you say, whether we use a credit card or not. I switch from a credit card to a debit card. It just saves me the trouble of writing checks. It's so simple. It's like writing a check without writing a check, and I love that. I just have to remember to log the amount in my checkbook when I make a purchase, and I do it immediately after doing it so I don't forget. I think once or twice I did forget, but generally I'll log the amount in right away so I don't forget, and it's a very simple way for me. The only difference in price when you buy something, say from a retailer, is maybe you get a lower price if you buy it online compared to if you walk in their store and you have to pay for the clerk's salary. So you pay 2% if you use your credit card, and if you walk in the store, you have to pay the clerk's salary and pay the rent and the rest of it. I mean, we're damned if we do and damned if we don't, Ellen. Generally, you can get a better price. I think lots of times when you buy stuff online, and there are lots of discounts around, so you can get around the onerous extra burden. But my goodness, 2% compounded.
is 60%. Yeah.
It is shocking.
In Costa Rica, they still do Visa and MasterCard. These publicly owned banks give Visa and MasterCard. But because they own the bank, they get to keep the 2% fee, the merchant's fee. So that is another bonus or dividend that goes back to the government. That's why their government is doing brilliantly well compared to all those other countries, although they have no resources. It's not like they have oil or anything like that. They've got nothing except coffee, and that's just, you know, they're fertile land. That's about it. But their public banks take advantage of that 2% and keep it for the people, for the benefit of the people. So our public bank in California could do the same thing. So that's another huge source of income, that 60% a year on credit cards.
Again, it makes so much sense, Ellen, and we literally never would have had the problem that we've been going through now for 5 years, and it never went away for ordinary people. I mean, the banks and the big corporations have done very well because they've been flooded with free money that they haven't used to grow the economy. They've grown their companies. Well, they've grown their companies as they need to meet the demand for their products and services. But so much of it has been used for speculative purposes, and that's fueled the market reaction really up in an unprecedented way. It's incredible the way the market has gone up from the bottom back in I believe it was March 2009, and it was a rough couple of days at the end of the week, Ellen. There's no way of knowing whether it's a signal that things are changing, but I do know that China's robust economy is a little bit less robust than it has been in recent months or years, and a lot of people are very suspicious about the numbers coming out of China anyway, that really the reported growth may not be quite as robust as they say it is, but it's on a downturn, not an upturn, and the manufacturing, at least in the last month, and I think maybe previously a couple of months, has been contracting rather than expanding, and China has been a major impetus for world growth. So if China goes down and if Bernanke keeps tapering, which apparently will continue at least one more time, whether it will continue if things continue to get very rocky on Wall Street, we'll have to wait and see. And his days are numbered because he's leaving office in just about a week. Next Friday is his last day. And then Janet Yellen comes in as Fed chairman, and I think she'll probably end up being a clone of Bernanke. And we have the former Bank of Israel governor, they call him a governor over there instead of a chairman, Stanley Fischer, a Zionist zealot coming in as the vice president, as the vice chairman, as soon as he gets confirmed by the Senate. But that's a rubber stamp procedure, and I don't know what the Senate is doing right now, Ellen, but they'll rubber stamp him in, and two other governors that Obama, a new one he appointed and another one he nominated to for another term as a Fed governor. So three new ones, they'll be rubber stamped in. And the Fed, the thing I can't understand about Stanley Fischer, he's such a right-wing extremist, and literally it'll be giving Israel a say over U.S. monetary policy. I just find that appalling.
It is. It's really quite shocking. And there's so many, our Fed really has potential. There are things you could do with, it's a giant credit machine, which is something we could use to our benefit. I mean, there, you could give credit to students, to homeowners, to businesses, small businesses, to local governments. That's such a no-brainer that if you can give 0.25% loans to Wall Street banks, why can't you give 0.25% loans to California directly and save the middleman and all those things, that all those risks that we take with credit default swaps and interest rate swaps and all those things that are supposed to be for our benefit but turn out to be a big casino and we lose the bet. But they literally can't do it because of the wording of the Federal Reserve Act. So that would be up to Congress to change the act. So that's another thing that I just write on continually to just shed some light here, that the idea of a government issuing its own credit is actually a good thing. I mean, the fact that we have a source of credit is a good thing, but they're not using it for the right thing. It's not going in the right place. It all goes to Wall Street. It's designed to go to Wall Street. That's the way the language of the act is written. But there have been times when it didn't. Like in the 1930s, there was a provision in the act which allowed loans to businesses. And so these different Federal Reserve branches could make loans directly to businesses in their district. And that worked out very well, but they took that out, of course, because it was competing with the private banks. I don't know. But we could do that again. There are a number of things we could do with it if we had a truly enlightened Federal Reserve chairman. But it's not looking like, you say, it's not looking like we're going to get a great change. The best thing I've heard about her is that she's got diplomatic skills. In other words, she's very nice. So she gets along with everybody. So that's a good thing. I mean, it's better than Larry Summers anyway, apparently, who offended people routinely.
I kind of like an equal opportunity offender. It's the people riled up against that person. I mean, I wrote about Larry Summers. I wrote about Yellen twice, I believe, and I wrote about Larry Summers. I honestly thought he would be the nominee. I thought he was the guy Wall Street wanted. Maybe he put his foot in his mouth too many times, and he ruined it for himself. But he's a very bright guy. Harvard threw him out. He was Harvard president. After he was Clinton's Treasury Secretary, and was he chairman of Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors? He might have had that post as well. He was a close economic advisor to the Clinton administration. I know that, mm-hmm. And he was there when Glass-Steagall got repealed and the Commodity Future Modernization Act was passed that licensed the proliferation of derivatives. He was responsible for that stuff at the end of the Clinton administration. End of 1999, beginning of 2000, Clinton went out about January 20, 2000, and in his waning days, he took full advantage to do those terrible, terrible, terrible laws that passed. But I don't know what Yellen was doing at that time. I have no faith in her at all. I have no faith in anybody sitting on the board. I think basically Wall Street picks the people, and they're just rubber stamped by the administration makes the announcement, and Congress, the Senate, rubber stamps the approval. It would take a real rogue for the Senate to turn down a candidate. I suppose one could come around every now and then, but like a Larry Summers, maybe if they found out he not only did some stupid things like being extremely offensive to the wrong people, but actually committed crimes and got caught doing them. But he was president of Harvard for a short time, and he offended women. He basically called them inferior to men. He offended the Harvard faculty. There were many on the Harvard faculty that demanded the administration get rid of this guy. And finally, I guess the pressure was too great, and they finally dumped him. It's very unusual for something like that to happen. So he came back in the limelight, and now he's gone again. But we won't shed any tears for Larry Summers, Ellen. He makes millions of dollars. I forget the firms that he's connected with. I think I mentioned at least one of them in the article that I wrote. But he's well-connected. He makes lots of money. So don't cry for Larry Summers.
Yeah, agreed.
And even as Fed chairman, you know, you make a pretty decent salary. And I guess the real deal is when you come out, you get multi-million dollar book deals. You go on the lecture circuit for maybe $100,000 a pop. The only thing wrong with Alan Greenspan doing it is I think he came out when he was about 80 years old, so his span left in his life is a little bit short unless he's lucky and lives to 100. I guess a lot of scoundrels may live to that ripe old age, but he's in his 80s now. I think he's making a fortune, also becoming an advisor, a rainmaker, let's put it that way, a rainmaker for investment firms or whatever, so they can make a ton of money once they leave the Fed post. But the prestige of the Fed post is very nice while you have it. I'd like to see a responsible fit chairperson, Ellen. That's why I want you for the job.
Thanks. Well, if elected, if nominated, yeah.
You will accept.
Sure.
Well, if I could be president, I guarantee you on day one, there are a lot of things I'd want to do on day one, and one of them is getting you into the top posts. If Treasury Secretary and Fed Chairman were too much for you, we'll give you that post and give you two assistants so they could help you with each one of them. but put you in charge of the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, and make it a real Federal Reserve, not a fake one.
Yeah, or if we were in Congress, another option, and could rewrite that Federal Reserve Act, that would be useful. But really, really, I'm a writer, and like you, and you know, my role, I think, is to just spread information. And what I really love is to peer into things and see what's really going on. And then you have that light bulb experience, like, aha, I knew it was something like that. And then you write it up in your best prose to. So that other people get it, and that I find that really satisfying. So that's really, really what I do.
Oh, I feel the same way. We need to take a break, Ellen. We're going to do that. And hold your thought. I'll hold one thing on my mind, and we'll pick it up as soon as we come back. Welcome back. Talking with Ellen Brown, her candidacy for treasurer of the state of California. Ellen, I also, like you, I prefer to write. I prefer to do media work. It really has become a passion for me late in life. I certainly had a much different life during my conventional working life, and I began what I'm doing now, all in retirement. For a short period, I was in the Army in California back in the 1950s, up at Fort Ord that no longer exists, hasn't existed in a long time, up in the Monterey Bay Area. I was there in the 1950s, and in our small family business, I spent almost a couple of years in San Diego, which was a very delightful time for me. It was the beginning of my involvement in the business that we were in. And for a very short time, I don't know why, it was like something strange came over me. I had a yen at some point to want to get involved in politics, you know, start at a local level, and if I had a taste for it, maybe do something else beyond that. Of course, I couldn't do anything while I was involved in business. I was simply too busy. It was a new operation, and it really took all of my time and then some. I mean, I didn't have enough time to spend with my family at the time, let alone think about politics. But the thought crossed my mind that it was a very tempting idea. It didn't stay with me all that long. It passed, and I'm not at all disappointed that I decided that that was not what I wanted to do. It could be a very rough business, and to this day, I really didn't have a yen for politics. At the same time, if there was a chance that I could make a difference, which is what your intention really is, if you ever could get into a situation like become treasurer of California where you could make a difference, if I could do that, then I would be of great interest to me to get involved. At this late stage in my life, if I could write and do media work, I guess I could do politics as well.
Yeah. Well, that's actually my feeling too, and this does take a lot more time than I thought I was envisioning, but it does have potential. Like today we have the internet, so you can reach a lot more people. Then it's not like you have to go around and make speeches to everybody in order to reach them. You can do it by writing articles, and we have along with this new jungle primary rule. In California, instead of 150 signatures to get on the ballot, you need 10,000 signatures. Mm. Well, we're not going to get 10,000 signatures by mid-February, but the other alternative is $2,800. So just pay the money. I mean, some people are going around and giving speeches and so forth, but it seems to me that I can have a lot more effect by writing articles, which is what I have always done anyway, and I'm pretty good at that. So,
indeed,
so we
you
can,
are.
Influence a lot of people. We had done first I wrote books, and then I started writing articles, and then I mean after the 2008 collapse, I started writing about the public banking option, and then we had a Google group that went round and round on these issues for a couple of years, and then when we felt that we knew what was going on, we felt we were experts in the subject, we thought it was about time we got out and did something. So we formed the Public Banking Institute, and that's been promoting, you know, it's just an educational tool promoting this idea of having a publicly owned bank. And then we got as far as we could with that, and then it seemed like, well, it was time to go out there and actually do it, since we were having, you know, rather than try to persuade legislators, maybe we should become the legislators. So I know that, I mean, I realize what a great long shot it is, but there are other people who are running for office that might actually have a shot at getting public banks implemented as legislators rather than just trying to persuade their legislators.
That would be a wonderful way to do it on a federal level, which, of course, is light years away of the possibility of anything happening. But Congress alone, if we had a responsible Congress, new legislation could be passed that would sweep away the old rules and institute new rules, whether it's rewriting the Federal Reserve Act or simply enacting new laws that simply override the old order and instituting something completely different than we have now. I mean, even to keep the old order and legitimize, authorize the establishment of a public bank at a federal level, my God, at any level, that would be a wonderful thing to do. But of course, it's impossible today. But just imagine, Ellen, if a state like California at some point ever established a public bank. California is so significant, again, even today, the equivalent of the ninth largest country in the world. If California ever established a public bank, it would be a game changer in America. I think that would break the wall of resistance and would see other states join in. Might not happen overnight, but I think we'd see it. And the more states, you at some point you get another one, then another one, then another one. And usually change, for some reason, begins in the West and moves east, just like the wind currents. But again, that would be wonderful. I hope I live long enough to see a little bit of that. That would be terrific. That would literally change the course of the country. America could become the progressive land, the land of democracy that it certainly is not now. It's exactly the opposite. But if we had public banking, we could see responsible governance go with it.
Yeah.
What a dream.
It does seem like you almost have to have some sort of revolution. Of course, we don't want a violent revolution, but in Costa Rica, for example, they did have a revolution in 1949 because the people were so desperately poor and they just weren't going to live that way. And so the winner of the Civil War realized that if he wanted to prevent another Civil War, he was going to have to just change the whole system. So what he did was to nationalize a number of industries, including banking, and just made them public utilities. And then when he had some resistance from the military, I guess there were a couple of military coups, he just got rid of the military, which I thought was a brilliant idea. What if we had no military? Think about it. We could save like 50% of our tax. Or we could, you know, double our budget for things that actually help the people. Or what if we turn the military into a national, a national engine for rebuilding the country? So you wouldn't unemploy those people. You'd still employ them, but you'd employ them for something good for us instead of something bad for other countries, you know, something that's aggressive on other countries. There are just so many possibilities. We're so close to, we're on the verge of another, a whole different way of living, but we can't get from here to there because of these political sort of roadblocks. And so that's the question. How do you break through those political roadblocks?
It's so tough. It's so tough. And, of course, meaningful change can never come quickly. But it certainly can come because America has changed many times from the time it was established to the way it is today. So, I mean, it's been reinvented in the wrong ways. It certainly can be reinvented in the right ways. But it starts with public knowledge about what's going on. You can't make people care about stuff, but you certainly can inform them. And because of the Internet, all the information people need is right there if they just take a minimum amount of time to find out. And I've said it so often in this program that people would just take that minimum amount of time, get informed and stay informed, and realize how the policies of their government at the state, federal, and local levels cause so much harm to the great majority. If they realize that and decided they're not going to take it anymore, I'm all in favor of a revolution. I want a nonviolent one also. But the only way to bring change is from the bottom up. There's no other way. You can't go to the polls and elect new people who are going to replace the bums you want out, because all you get are new bums. So ordinary people have to do it on their own. And when enough people rally for big things, change can come. And America has gotten it before. I've talked about it on this program, ending slavery, civil rights, labor rights. We got these things. But you got to keep up the struggle, because when the energy wanes, the gains are lost. And that's exactly what's happened, including on slavery, which the chattel form still exists in some forms. Most people don't realize it. In America, yes, chattel slavery. I've written about it a couple of times. But we've got wage slavery, you know, serfdom, paying people minimum wages, starvation wages, poverty wages, sub-poverty wages. If that isn't slavery, I don't know what is. And those are the people lucky enough to have jobs. There are so many of them who simply can't find a job. But that can change if enough people decide they won't take it, and if they do something about it. And I'm old enough to remember the stuff that went on in the 1960s, the things I remember so well. The great labor struggles earlier, I wasn't old enough to remember those. I need to be about 120 or 30 to remember those, going back into the 1930s and 1930s. I think so much of that went on when the Labor Relations Act was passed, National Labor Relations Act was passed under Franklin Roosevelt, a game-changing act. But all the benefits in that act are lost now. But the civil rights struggles, I remember that so well, so well. And I had a great civil rights leader I invited, and he came to one of the programs that I put on in San Diego, as a matter of fact, Ellen. I had to pay him a little bit of money to come, but he came, and he spoke to us, and that was something I won't forget. Didn't he get Martin Luther King? I think that was before he was killed. But it wasn't long before he was killed. It was very close to when he was killed. But that would have been marvelous to have somebody like him come. But change can come, Ellen.
We have our upcoming conference we're planning for Detroit, which is we're talking about who to get for speakers now, so I was just thinking of that. But Detroit is a place that I would say literally is being taken over. I mean, they're democracy has been defeated by big bankers who have come in. Big money is coming in and imposing their emergency manager, now imposing the bankruptcy court, so that the mayor basically has nothing to do. The mayor was elected by the people, but he has no voice. That it's the emergency manager, and the job of the emergency manager is to say, You have to pay your debts first. You can't worry about your people. You can't worry about your roads, et cetera. You have to pay off your debts to Wall Street and your debts to other, you know, your debts to everybody but the pensioners, basically. In order to pay off your foreign debts, meaning to New York, you're going to have to cut off your obligations to your pensioners. Well, those pensions, first of all, they're not huge. I think the average pension was $2,000 a month. So it's not like they're huge CEO payments or something. These are enough to live on, and that's it. They don't get Social Security, so that's it. They live on this $2,000 a month. And they worked, no doubt, at a lesser pay for the city, thinking that, well, at least their old age was taken care of. It was security. You know, that was part of the deal, and now they're being cut off, the firemen, the policemen, et cetera, that have risked their lives or whatever. Now they will be cut off from having any sort of support, which is a clear violation of contracts. It's also a violation of the Michigan state constitution. But the bankruptcy court held that federal law trumps state law, even when it's the state constitution. It seems to me that we need a totally new Bill of Rights, something that says you have a right to survive. You have a right to basic health care. And the only way we would afford, be able to afford basic health care, it seems to me, is it has to be, we have to be both sides. In other words, it has to be something like they have in England, which is the UK, which is socialized medicine. In other words, if we can't have private contractors that are charging us anything they want to charge and then forcing people to buy insurance to cover that, if you're going to force everybody to pay collectively for everybody else, you've got to also force the suppliers to deal with, you know, in other words, it has to be a totally socialized system. I know in Russia, I trained on a little device. I used to write on alternative medicine before I got into banking, and I trained on this Russian device called a Scanar from a Russian doctor in England. She was giving the class, and she said that in Russia, they had no money, and it was their job to keep people well. So they looked for the things that would be the cheapest and most effective remedies. So they actually developed a number of new remedies that hadn't, you know, been done before that were low cost and effective, that actually worked. Now, we have a model that's totally the opposite of that. Drug companies make the most money if they don't get you well. If they can keep you sick for 40 years and make you take a blood pressure drug or a cholesterol drug or something like that, they make a lot more money than if they had a pill that would make you, that would cure the disease overnight. That's the type of remedy they don't want, is a cure, because their market is sick people.
Well, indeed. So anyway, we don't have a healthcare system, Ellen. Yeah. We have a sickness. We have a sickness industry. And indeed, of course, the insurance companies would like people to stay well so they don't have to pay any expenses for medical bills. But the big hospital chains make out. The drug companies make out. The medical equipment makers make out. It's a huge amount of money. And it's Katie by the door. As you say, they can charge anything you want. It's a ripoff. As far as Detroit goes, Ellen, it's a case study. And literally the strip mining of an industrial colossus, a once industrial colossus of America. A comment I made, I wrote a few times about Detroit, not recently, but a comment I made in one of them was to the effect that Motown was now a ghost town, and that's exactly what it became. But it was really shocking because you go back to the 1960s or the post-war period or during the war. I mean, Detroit was the heart of industrial America, and I guess along with Pittsburgh, the steel capital of America, Pittsburgh reinvented itself, and Detroit is literally a ghost town today, and what's going to happen to it, who knows?
Yeah, my dad's family is from Detroit, and so I heard those Depression stories all my life, and I grew up in Michigan myself until I was 12, and of course, Detroit at one time was the most modern industrialized city in the country. It's shocking what they've lost, like half their population, for various reasons. But one reason General Motors got trashed was that they were subject to a leverage buyout. I mean, it's this whole thing where the hedge funds come in and they buy up the company on credit, and then they pay back the loan by selling off the assets of the company. In other words, it's all about making money for the investors. It's not about making a product. It's not about maintaining the workers. In fact, you'll get rid of the workers if that will make the most money for the investors. So our whole model, I think, is wrong. And it seems to me that people are realizing more and more that it's wrong. I went to a lecture by Richard Wolff about a week ago here in L.A., and it was just bursting at the seams in that room, and he was quite shocked himself. He said, I've been giving these lectures for, I don't remember what he said, 20 years or something like that. He said, they've never been so popular as now. I mean, people are totally disillusioned with our capitalist system and looking for something else.
Indeed they are. And Obama, next Tuesday night, I believe, will give his annual State of the Union address. For sure I will write about it. It'll be another exercise in demagogic boilerplate. He'll talk about income inequality. He spent 5 years in office doing everything possible to widen the wealth gap between rich and poor, and he's going to make a speech calling it a great problem and we need to address it, while at the same time he demands big cuts in Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid. He's not happy with the amount of food stamps that have been cut from desperate poor people that need the food stamps to eat. He wants more billions cut out of it. He says one thing and he does exactly the opposite. But he'll give the speech. It'll get a good review in the New York Times, some of the other major publications, and I'm going to rip it apart the next day. I don't know if I wrote about all of his State of the Union addresses, but I wrote about a few of them, and I'll write about this one as well, probably next Wednesday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm kind of at a loss to what to comment next.
Well, he's all for raising the minimum wage. I don't believe in a minimum wage. I believe in a living wage. Nobody should be paid less than the amount of money they need to pay their basic expenses, keep a roof over their heads, get food into the house, pay their medical bills, take care of all their necessities. Nobody should be paid a wage that does not take care of that. And if you're one person, you need so much. If you're two, you need more, and so on and so forth. But the poverty line in America, by the Census Bureau, is so way out of date, and the Census Bureau even admits it. It goes back to a model over 40 years ago, $23,500 for a family of four. Nobody in Chicago can live on an income like that. I guess you can, but you'll be deeply impoverished, and how you'll get by, I don't know. You certainly won't be able to have any sort of a decent life.
Yeah, and we're working for them. I mean, even if you manage to get by, when do you have time to do anything that's meaningful? You know, to write things that I know in the Middle Ages they thought it was the duty of the upper class to do art and literature and writing and so forth, because most people didn't have the time for it. So that's the way it is today. I mean, most people don't have the time to think about politics, or if they do, they turn on Fox News and they catch the first 5 minutes. I actually used to do that when we would get, you know, we were in the Foreign Service, we got, we would get company, and so I would think, well, I better find out what's going on in the world so I don't sound like an idiot, and I would just turn on and catch the first 5 minutes of the news. So you'll get whatever slant that station gives you, and that's it. I mean, they just don't have time to explore for themselves. I think that's part of keeping everybody working and keeping everybody working at two jobs, or keeping them working, you know, so that their entire life has gone toward work, and that the few minutes that they have left over, they do the laundry and they have a beer and relax, and that's it, because they don't really want people to wake up to have the time and the energy to get into all these issues, which they have made unnecessarily complex, like banking, for example, which could be very easy. All we're talking about here is a medium of exchange, that money is basically credit. Somebody has done something for somebody else, and the other person doesn't necessarily want what the first person has in return. They want a credit that they can go spend in the market. So it's just an agreement among all of us that we'll take these little credits in payment of an equivalent sum in goods and services. Anyway, it's fairly straightforward what money's all about, but they've made it so complicated and made banking seem so complicated, and the Federal Reserve, and that most people just sort of shy away from the subject altogether. So we've been enslaved in numerous ways, but hopefully the day is dawning when light will burst forth largely from the Internet.
Indeed. So, I mean, they keep us, they treat us like mushrooms, Ellen, well-watered and in the dock. Again, they get propaganda for news on TV. They get junk food news, meaningless junk that means absolutely nothing. And the rest of the time, you're well-watered with sports and movies and all. I don't know what they have on TV now. I don't know if they have game shows or what the heck they have. I don't watch that crap. I simply can't, by the way, it's an insult. And you get deluged with commercials. We are out of time. I've got to sign off. Commercials. I have a commercial-free home. I consider commercials pollution. Pollution. They absolutely are banished from my household.
Yeah.
Ellen, I look forward to
it. We don't watch TV. We watch our video screen, a big video screen where you can put on documentaries. There's some really great documentaries these days if you have time to explore and you don't have to deal with commercials.
Oh, indeed. You can get good stuff online. I've got to sign off. Ellen, many
thanks. It's great talking to
you. Oh, same here. I look forward to more next month. Join us next week, every Friday, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends, 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.